Previously on Beta.
This is the Central Scrutinizer. Joe has just worked himself into an imaginary frenzy.
Hiya, kids! It's Andy's gang!
This is a true story about a famous criminal from right around Chicago.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
This was the story that, when I read it, I kept doing a double take. I could not believe this was actual American history that I was reading, and I couldn't believe that I hadn't heard much about it, really.
That's Sam Anderson talking about the actual American history of Oklahoma. Oklahoma isn't just the place where the wind comes sweeping down the plain. The Sooner State also hosts one of the world's weirdest cities, Oklahoma City. Sam joins us today to talk about the strange history of OKC. So much crazy stuff has happened there that you'll probably find yourself saying, "What the f-?" And we'll find out why that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Swearing is good for you in the way that a high-fiber diet is good for you. Running is good for you. You don't want it to be the only thing you ever do.
Emma Byrne explains why using bad language can be a good thing. But we'll kick things off with Terrence Nance. He's the creator of the HBO series Random Acts of Flyness. The show explores what it's like to be young and black in contemporary America. A recent story about Terrence posed the question, is America ready for Terrence Nance? Obviously, Beta is. Are you?
What up, world? It's Terrence Nance here. Welcome to Random Acts of Flyness, a show about the beauty and ugliness of contemporary American life. Today, we got a whole bunch of flyness, fly stuff for you today.
You can't be riding a bike and texting at the same time.
Sir, officer, I was not texting. I was filming my television show.
Television.
It's Gainful Employment. Yes, you are actually on the television show right now, sir.
How would I describe it? I think that, in general, I think that the title is the best description of the show.
Oh, yeah, it's a great title.
It is hard for me to even find accurate descriptors for. So usually if I'm asked to do that, I just ask what whoever's asking me likes on television.
Yeah.
And then I kind of find a way to lean it towards that, whatever they decided they liked. Because I think that there's a lot of things happening. So often I can find a way to make it relatable to anything that that person might like.
Let's play this out a bit. We had Justin Simeon on a few months ago about Dear White People. Compare and contrast Random Acts of Flyness with Dear White People.
That's a great question. I mean, Justin's a friend of mine, you know, a huge supporter of his. He's been really great supporting me and my work just over the years, you know, for a while. You know, we come from the same culture and community. So I think that a lot of just the underlying conversations that inspire the show are similar, if not the same. And I think that where there's a big point of commonality is I think that we both have a experience of being 20s and 30s in America at a time when internet culture, we both know what it's like to not have a phone, to like walk around for a summer and not have a phone, and then also know what it's like to kind of be digital natives as black people, male-embodied black people. And I think that a lot of what's common about the shows is that we're navigating, expressing ourselves at that kind of border, like we're in that border town of generations.
Very well said.
Thank you.
Your show is just very different in terms of the presentation, the way you mix all these different elements. You got the verite, documentary, musical performances, a lot of surrealism, surrealist melodrama, humorous animation, claymation. In terms of the surrealism, one reviewer has said that if we were able to put Random Acts of Flyness into a category, maybe the most appropriate category for your show would be Afro-surrealism, this literary and cultural aesthetic, which is a response to mainstream surrealism and is an effort to reflect people of color's lived experience. So I'm curious, do you see Random Acts of Flyness as Afro-surrealism?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that there's just a healthy dose of abstraction and surrealism at play in the show. I don't think that aspect of the show is necessarily what makes it hyper different than all the other shows. You know, in Dear White People, There's characters talking to dogs. In Atlanta, there's an invisible car and light comes out of chicken boxes. And I think in Lisa Ray talks to herself in the mirror. So I think that there's a shared aesthetic rendering of our experience that I think other people experience as surreal, but I think for us, it's actually naturalism in a way. I think that when we're kind of dealing with expressing our experience, it's more natural for us to use imagery and sounds that engage the metaphysical, I think, at the end of the day, because I think a metaphysical experience of the world is natural for us, for our generation of Black people, for sure. And I think that's why that kind of exists across the spectrum of everything that's happening now, movies and TV, for just our generation of artists.
One of the most powerful segments in the first episode of Random Acts of Flyness is Everybody Dies. Can you tell me about this segment?
Yeah, I mean, Everybody Dies, I think, really encapsulates a lot of what the show is trying to do, which is find ways to put forth and express the layers of the emotional experience of what it's like to be, specifically in that case, like Francis Bodomo or Terrence Nance or Mariama Diallo, in kind of like our experience of trauma today. And I think that Frances made that piece kind of as the pilot was being made. She co-wrote it with Mariama Diallo and made it as part of this project called Collective Unconscious. And when she was making it and talking about it, I definitely identified with all the emotions that were at play. Mm-hmm. But specifically just like the absurdity that just all humans would experience, but definitely like Black people experience when confronted with so many images of the state murdering children, Black children. And I think that the absurdity that kind of comes after the anger and sadness gets centralized in a way that I hadn't experienced before, because I think the absurdity of the layers of emotion of like, you know, you can't process any more sadness, so maybe it will become funny for at least a moment. And then you can't process the humor, so then maybe it will become rage or defiance, at least for a moment. And I'd never seen anything that had all those layers, emotional layers, stacked at once and that I identified with so readily.
Take my hand, walk through the door, and you'll live in this world no more.
There, there, kids. There, there. Everybody dies. You might not be ready, but I'm ready for you. You might slip in the shower. You might get hit by a car. You might get sick and die slowly.
The Murder Man.
You might be running from the police. You might be running from a stranger who thinks he's the police. You might be playing with a toy gun. You might be not selling cigarettes. Everybody dies, it's true. Him and her and you and you. Kids beware when they attack, especially if you are Black.
Another standout segment in the first episode is the commercial parody for White Be Gone, which is this topical cream that can be used to treat white thoughts, which are a sign of a disease called acute viral perceptive albinitis. That's what the pitchman, played by John Hamm, tells us. How did you come up with the idea for White Be Gone?
I don't know how I came up with it. It just sort of like came into my mind one day. It was definitely post the election. I think the initial idea came from a place of just trying to make sense of, you know, a lot of deep-seated anger probably. But I don't know. I've probably intentionally forgotten whatever emotional space it came from.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that what it ended up morphing into was more, well, not even as more, is firmly about the daily process of recentering oneself when kind of having to deal with the onslaught of oppressive forces around you. And that, you know, that applies whether you're Black or a woman or both or in any kind of state of being compromised, your health being compromised. And I think that, you know, by an oppressive force or a system of oppression. And I think that that process of turning away that kind of happens in the segment is really what it's about. And I think that idea of the turning away and re-embracing what actually sustains you or what makes you came about after the script had been written and I shared it with my DP, Sean Peters. And I think that that kind of moment, that fulcrum, comes from him and really our dialogue and our ongoing dialogue as brothers and artists, you know.
Do you suffer from white thoughts? White thoughts are a symptom of an aggressive disease called acute viral perceptive albinitis.
Violence isn't the answer.
Also known is whiteness. The whiteness virus targets healthy, culturally and ethnically specific cells. Italian, Irish, Scandinavian, etc. And what have you. The albinitis then attacks and destroys any cultural or ethnic specificity using an arsenal of fake holidays, 17th century aristocratic class warfare, the one drop rule, and Elvis. Luckily, we have a cure. White Beyond.
And I also think that it's funny to even think about that now. I just saw this response video from a YouTuber. It was just hilarious. Basically, the coda of the response video was, it's okay to be white, and having white thoughts is okay, and you should be proud to have white thoughts. It was just really funny because I was like, wow, he played right into it. Like he really like internalized like this part of it that was sort of just like a red herring, like the whole, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just funny, you know, to kind of think about it like that.
Yeah, something very interesting happens at the end of the White Be Gone segment because we see you looking at your computer and you're exchanging these text messages with your show's first assistant director, Annalise Lockhart. And Annalise writes, quote, "It seems to me that as artists, we should be addressing whiteness less and affirming blackness more," end quote. And it's a bit of meta commentary, and it raises an important question about the content of Random Acts of Flyness. How much of the show should you spend addressing whiteness, and how much of the show should you spend affirming blackness? It seems to me that they're both parts of the same equation, and you can't have one without the other. What do you think?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the extent to which blackness is a offshoot of white supremacy and resultant even from, especially like the sort of American iteration of blackness, is resulted from a system of oppression called white supremacy. You know, I think it's a little bit up for debate, but to quote Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, he says that they made us into a race and we made ourselves into a people. And I think that there's a peopling, you know, or a recentering of ourselves that can and does happen consistently and daily that is not inclusive of whiteness as like cultural force. And I think that that iteration of blackness is an intentional space that is and has always been consistently created. And I think that there's a way of living within it and the expanse of it that doesn't acknowledge or deal with or interact with the system of oppression of white supremacy. But that said, I think that there clearly must be some sort of, maybe therapeutic, but just there's some sort of release that might happen in some sort of dialogue with whiteness and or white supremacy that is foundational to black people and black entertainment and black entertainers and black artists, clearly. And I think that to that point, white thoughts is funny. It's funny to watch. You know what I mean? It's like there's some sort of satisfaction there in saying those things or getting them out, even if they aren't maybe in the larger sense what progress me as a black person forward in my kind of emotional or spiritual dealings with white supremacy. But maybe it does, you know? And I think that that kind of interaction is a little bit, it clearly is foundational. And I think that the jury is still out, or at the very least, it's very subjective, the extent to which it's like a productive experience for black artists or black people. And I think I have space for the fact that we don't know, and I don't know, and that I have a different opinion about it every day, you know?
Yeah, sure. Who is the audience for Random Acts of Flyness? Do you have an ideal viewer or viewers in mind?
Everybody should watch the show. there's definitely no ideal audience, you know? Obviously, I'm the first audience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making it so that I can, you know, communicate back to myself most accurately. But past that, which is to say nothing, you know.
Yeah.
There's definitely no ideal audience. Everyone should watch it.
Yeah, that's what I thought you'd say. Yeah, and I'm glad you say that. So the New York Times published a profile of you with the headline, "Is America Ready for the Mind of Terrence Nance?" Do you, Terrence Nance, think that America is ready for your mind?
I mean, of course.
Yeah, you wouldn't be doing this. Yeah.
What is readiness? I think that is anybody ready for anything, you know, that is going to affect them? You know, I don't know. It's just like a weird thing to aspire to.
Terrence Nance is the creator of the HBO series Random Acts of Flyness. You can find out more about Terrence at wpr.org/beta.
Swearing also helps deal with those social pains, that feeling of shame or embarrassment or exclusion.
The upside of coarse language. Maybe it's time to change our attitudes about swearing. You may think that's a bunch of bull, but you'd be wrong. Stay tuned to find out why. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Many people drop a cuss word now and then. Some feel guilty about it. But it turns out that swearing may have a bad reputation. Letting the expletives fly may not be such a terrible thing to do after all. That's the argument that Dr. Emma Byrne, the sweary scientist, makes in her book, Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language.
Well, it's a terrific paradox. So most of the things that are good for us, we kind of have to force ourselves to do. So eating healthily, taking more exercise, you know, they're not the kinds of things that necessarily come easy to most of us. But swearing is something that's both good for us and we spend a lot of time trying to not do it. Once I started to realize how much of a benefit swearing has for us, both as individuals and as a wider society, it became really strange to me, or it seemed really strange to me, to keep telling ourselves we ought not to be doing it. And In the course of researching the book, the picture emerged that one of the things that keeps swearing so powerful, that helps it have this strong effect, is the fact that it remains taboo. And once you've lost that taboo, that what used to be a swear word, for example, just doesn't have the same impact now, and it doesn't have those benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart had that famous quote about hardcore pornography. He said, "I know it when I see it." And so to riff off of that famous quote, I guess we could say that we know swearing when we hear it. But there's got to be more to it than that. How do you define a swear word?
No one's ever written down a sort of an intentional definition of swearing, as in something that is a set of checklists or characteristics that tell you for sure that something is or is not a swear word. So what constitutes swearing and what constitutes vulgarity or strong language or however it's defined varies from study to study and from time to time. But the things that they have in common are the fact that swearing is always to do with something that's taboo. It's a concept or a word or a something that you wouldn't talk about without having a really good mental model of the person that you're talking to ordinarily. So they are things that could be intensely private, like, you know, bodily functions, for example. Or there are things that are potentially to do with what used to be thought of as word magic. This is where blasphemy gets its power, or where using the names of illnesses as swear words in some languages come from. So that sense of taboo, that sense that you might make a very powerful social faux pas by using it, that's part of the swearing. And the other part of it is that we reserve that kind of language for when we want to make a particularly emotive point, either deliberately or sometimes just because other language has failed us. For example, if you're injured or frustrated or something shocking happens, that's the language that remains when all other language has basically vanished. And so those are the two characteristics that let you know if a swear word is a swear word.
And I'm guessing there are also different categories of swear words?
That's right, yeah. And different countries sort of have different categories as being more important or a broader part of their vocabulary than others. So, for example, in Japan, things to do with excrement are just not that much of a swear word, which is why you've got the poop emoji, for example.
Yeah.
whereas, you know, in this country, in the United Kingdom, bodily functions are still somewhat of a taboo, and you can still use the word shit, for example, as a way of emphasizing that you're surprised or excited, or even saying more recently that something's good. You know, that's the shit. Whereas, for example, bodily functions like the copulatory one, the F word,
yes,
that's also used very, very fluidly in the UK. Whereas when you try to translate, for example, a film like Pulp Fiction into Spanish, there's some brilliant papers out of translation journals saying that you can't just keep translating the word fuck as fuck in Spanish because that's not the way it's used over there.
You talk about two different kinds of swearing, propositional swearing and non-propositional swearing. What are they?
Yeah, so this is one of the very good definitions that comes out of the scientific research, and it comes out of linguistics in general, and this idea that we have different forms of language, some of which is sort of rote or that comes out in particular situations, and we haven't really given it much conscious thought. That's the non-propositional part of language. Usually it's something that comes out when we are just not really thinking about what we're saying. Propositional swearing, on the other hand, is the stuff that you might not be picking your words particularly consciously, but they are being used to make a deliberate effect that you could go back and say why you chose that word. So propositional swearing, for example, is sometimes used what's called instrumentally as a means of making a point, of showing that you are particularly serious about a point or particularly angry or frustrated, for example.
You say that one of the benefits of swearing is that it can help us fit in at work. How?
Yeah, so this research, perhaps unsurprisingly, comes more out of the UK, Australia and New Zealand than it does out of North America. But there's something called jocular abuse. And within that, there's an awful lot of swearing. And this is a way of showing a kind of anti-authoritarian stance and a way of saying, you know, I'm not buttoned up. I'm not one of those people who's all taking myself far too seriously. And this kind of jocular abuse as well, it demonstrates that you have a very strong theory of mind about the person that you're insulting or that you're swearing at. And what you're saying is that I know that swearing is highly emotive. I know that if you didn't trust me, if you weren't my friend, that you would probably consider what I'm about to say incredibly offensive. But I'm trusting that you trust me enough that you know I'm joking. And the stronger the insult or the stronger the swear word is, that is used, the more likely it is that those people would actually describe themselves as very close friends. And with our less close friends, we use milder swearing or no swearing at all.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I would imagine that a lot of that is dependent on how people at your workplace feel about swearing. For example, my guess is that the people who work in standards and practices at the major TV networks would frown upon swearing, since that's part of their job, to make sure, you know, the major naughty words don't end up on the air. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe all of the standards and practices people swear like sailors in Quentin Tarantino movies. What do you think?
One of the things I've noticed is that talking to particularly production staff on radio and on-air talent like yourself is that there is that almost a kind of a pent-up feeling of I have to go through my professional life not swearing. And then the minute that the red light goes off, we're not recording anymore, that quite often people will then come out and swear a lot. And it's almost like that effort of saying, you know, everyone else is allowed to use this language and I'm not, and it's a little unfair, can sometimes lead to a bit of an outpouring, particularly at the end of an interview. But it is so varied, as you say, depending on the setting.
Sure. You say that another good thing about swearing is that it has helped to develop neuroscience. How the hell did it do that?
One of the ways that we know that swearing is very different to the rest of language is because of what happens when you have a stroke. If you have a stroke on the that affects the left side of the brain, it's very likely to impact some of the centres that are incredibly important in producing or understanding language. So there's a whole constellation of different areas that have been mapped out in the left side of the brain that help you, you know, create the muscle movements that they allow you to speak, or that allow you to turn your ideas into words. And all of those parts of the brain can be very easily damaged or disrupted by a stroke. And in fact, some people who have very severe brain injuries or brain pathologies end up losing the entire left hemisphere. You know, sometimes the entire of the left side of the brain is surgically removed. And in those people, one would expect that they would end up with no language whatsoever. Once that hemisphere's been removed, you tend to find that they can still swear. In fact, not only can they still swear, they do still swear, and they use it in a way that is emotionally and situationally appropriate. And over the years, different, you know, studying people with different types of brain injuries to different areas has revealed numerous things. Like, for example, that swearing, the language that we use to do with swearing, is basically has a kind of distributed architecture. It's not just in the left side of the brain where most of our propositional language is. It's also in the right side where a lot of the emotional processing goes on. And in fact, if you have a stroke that affects the right-hand side of the brain, two things generally happen. One is that you completely lose your sense of humour. Your ability to complete a joke or spot a punchline goes totally out the window. But also, both the desire to swear and also the recognition of where swearing might be appropriate also goes out the window. And it's that inability to model what the emotional state of someone else might be seems to rob us of that understanding of swearing.
The one time when it seems that we can't help but swear is when we experience pain. For example, when we hit our thumb with a hammer, it's almost impossible not to let the expletives fly. And it seems that it does help reduce the pain. Is there any research that's been done to find out whether or not swearing does help us deal with pain?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the first studies that really got me into this area in the first place. I used to work out of the Science Museum in London. Oh. And when we have people come in of an evening, we like to run experiments that they can participate in. So they have to be pretty straightforward. And there's a chap called Dr. Richard Stevens, who's up at the University of Kiel here in the UK. And he came up with this really elegant and simple experiment for looking at this. And all you need is a bucket of ice water and a stopwatch. And there's a couple of other controls involved, like making sure that people pick a swear word that is as easy to remember as the neutral word that they choose. But once they have a pair of words that they're prepared to use, you have them plunge their hands in ice water. And in one condition, they'll do the neutral word. In one condition, they'll say the swear word. And consistently, people who are swearing can keep their hands in ice water for about half as long again. Hmm. And not only that, when you interview them afterwards, they tend to rate the water as feeling less cold when their hand is in the ice water. And you can also measure physiological effects, like, for example, their heart rate going up or their palms getting quite sweaty. And so it's probably something to do, again, with that emotional center of the brain and the fact that swearing is somehow basically recruiting those emotions as a way of helping us be more resilient. And so the same team has followed that up, looking at things like whether or not aggressive video games can help you withstand pain more, which they can. Huh. And also whether or not swearing helps you be more, you know, be more powerful in the gym. So using one of those hand exercises where you squeeze a heavy spring, people can do that for much stronger and much longer when they're swearing than when they're not.
Another kind of pain that is part of the human condition is social pain, loneliness, and things like that. Does swearing help us deal with social pain?
Yeah, and that was one of the most fascinating sets of studies that I came across while I was looking at the book. So one of the reasons we know that social pain is as sort of neurologically real as physical pain is that you can reduce the intensity of social pain by administering, you know, acetaminophen or cannabis, for example. Mm-hmm. We also know that there's an interaction that if you give somebody a mild pain and then subject them to a clinically controlled amount of pain, they will say it's much, much worse than if they previously experienced a severe pain. So, for example, there is a terrifically cruel study in which the experimental manipulation was whether or not people were left out of a virtual game of catch or whether or not they were told that their psychological profile meant that they were completely unlovable and were going to die alone. Which is the cruelest thing I've ever seen, and this includes experiments where they're making people put their hands on hot light bulbs. And so when you've had that severe social pain, physical pain just doesn't feel as strong. But given that neurologically, social and physical pain is using exactly the same pathways in the brain, swearing also helps deal with those social pains, that feeling of, you know, sort of shame or embarrassment or exclusion.
Well, what's next for swearing?
I am slightly concerned. I see that particularly here in the UK and potentially also in North America, that the words that are slurs seem to be coming back into discourse as essentially a means of throwing out a negative emotion. And they have been used in a kind of reclaimed usage sense for quite a while. So if you belong to certain communities, like in the Black community, using the N-word is a sign of solidarity often. In the LGBTQ community, the word queer was reclaimed. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing, as we have this increasingly polarized debate, particularly in things like politics, that slurs are ways of shutting people down or of dismissing people as being less important than the current speaker. And that really concerns me because I like the bodily function swearing. Mm-hmm. And I see it losing its impact. But when you use a slur, you're talking about things that divide us. So I don't know where we go next. I'd like to see us invent a whole new set of curses that's to do with technology. You know, so may your Wi-Fi password be constantly misspelled, or, you know, may your Uber constantly go to the wrong address. I don't know. Yeah. Some kind of new curses for the 21st century, because I really don't don't want to see that kind of divisive language becoming the general purpose swearing.
Mm-hmm. One scenario that I can imagine is that after everyone reads your book, they'll be more likely to swear a lot more. They'll feel liberated. And assuming that this does indeed happen, this could mean that swearing could become more socially acceptable.
It's one of the things that I'm slightly concerned about. Mm. So assuming people make it as far as the conclusion, I do say that it's not really intended as a carte blanche to go out and swear as much as possible. I mean, swearing is good for you in the way that, you know, a high fiber diet is good for you, running is good for you. You don't want it to be the only thing you ever do. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of its impact and a lot of its strength comes from its very special position in our language. And so what I really want people to do is listen more when they hear swearing and not just immediately respond with that kind of visceral, emotional, you know, you said a bad word and now I don't want to listen to you anymore.
Yeah.
But also to realize that when they are moved to swear, that there's something really important going on in their own psychology, their own physiology, and to understand better what it is that they might be feeling or they might be trying to achieve with that swearing. So for myself, I realized how much I used swearing as kind of a positive signal to my male colleagues that I'm one of the blokes and to be taken seriously. And since I realized that that's what I was doing, I've tried to find other ways of appearing more credible. But it took that signal. It took me recognizing this desire to say, you will f-ing listen to me. that I realized that actually this is when I feel that desire, it's usually because I realize that I'm being spoken over or I've made a point in a meeting that someone else has made and it's only been picked up when someone with a beard has said it, for example.
Yeah.
And I realize then that swearing is just one of the ways that I can alter my behavior. So it's an excellent signal for me that I need to do something different, but I don't then necessarily have to use the word. So it's a really useful part of our language, but it's only useful in that we can choose to use it or not, or that it's available when we have those moments of real extremis. Otherwise, if it just becomes diluted to the point where it's almost mandatory to swear, it will lose its effectiveness.
Dr. Emma Byrne, the sweary scientist, is the author of Swearing is Good for You: The Amazing Science of Bad Language. You can find out more about Emma at wpr.org/beta. And you can let us know your comments and questions by sending a note to beta@wpr.org. I thought about saying that you shouldn't use any dirty words in your emails to us, but after talking to Emma, I'm not sure if that would be appropriate or not. What do you think?
The Thunder became this kind of symbol of the city's spirit, and people would gather in the arena to cheer them on, and they were really cheering on Oklahoma City.
Sam Anderson takes us on a tour of Oklahoma City. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta. Did you know that Oklahoma City is one of the great weirdo cities of the world? That's what Sam Anderson says. He says that OKC is as strange as Venice or Dubai or Versailles or Pyongyang, and that it's worth paying attention to regardless of what's going on in the news. And after reading Sam's book, Boomtown, I'm inclined to agree. Not only that, but Boomtown has one of the longest and most descriptive subtitles I've ever read. 24 words. The fantastical saga of Oklahoma City, its chaotic founding, its apocalyptic weather, its purloined basketball team, and the dream of becoming a world-class metropolis. As the subtitle indicates, the Oklahoma Thunder basketball team is an important part of the city's history.
When the Thunder arrived in 2008, Oklahoma City was kind of going through a little bit of a renaissance. It had been for decades kind of a laughingstock among American cities. It was a place out in the middle of nowhere. It had an empty downtown. It had no good restaurants. It had one functioning hotel. All the young people had left.
And it was just kind of a place you would never think to go for any reason. And even the people who lived there weren't necessarily happy being there. Mm-hmm. And so for them to go from that around the 80s and 90s to a city that one of 30 cities in North America to have an NBA franchise was a huge leap and something that they took great, great, great pride in. And so the Thunder became this kind of symbol of the city's spirit, and people would gather in the arena to cheer them on, and they were really cheering on kind of Oklahoma City, this improbable story of this abandoned place that was suddenly felt like the center of the world.
If you haven't seen us lately, it's time you paid a visit to America's latest big league city, Oklahoma City.
This is Don Hollenbeck in Oklahoma country. In exactly 27 minutes and 30 seconds at high noon on this 22nd day of April 1889, you will see the biggest land grab in the history of the United States.
Oklahoma City has one of the most incredible origin stories I've ever read about. And it all started with this event called the Land Run in 1889, thank you. Can you tell me about the Land Run?
This was the story that when I read it, I kept doing a double take. I could not believe this was actual American history that I was reading, and I couldn't believe that I hadn't heard much about it, really.
Yeah, me neither.
Oklahoma was, for a very long time, pretty deep into American history, Oklahoma was not a state. All the states around it had been set up, you know, Kansas and Texas and Colorado and New Mexico and so forth. But what we know today as Oklahoma was this space that was called at the time Indian Territory, and it was kind of the spot that the federal government used as European-based settlers came over and displaced all the Native Americans from every pocket of land on the continent. They kind of dumped them in Oklahoma and called it Indian Territory and said, you can have this land, you will be sovereign here, it's yours forever. And that held until the middle of the 19th century. And the Civil War kind of complicated that. A couple of tribes sided with the South, and the U.S. government, as punishment, took their land away. And so you had this spot in the middle of Indian Territory suddenly, very late again in the history of the United States when everything else was settled, that was suddenly wide open and belonged to nobody, and they called it the unassigned lands. The settlers of all the states around it said, well, what are you doing with that land? We want it. And the government said, no, you can't have it. We don't know what we're doing with it. And so the settlers started invading it and trying to found cities there. And eventually Congress said, fine, we give up. You can have it. And here's how we're going to do it. It's something called the Land Run. And they allowed anyone who wanted land inside of this territory to line up around the border of it, which was 300 miles long. Something around 100,000 people came. People came from all over the world, from Europe. And they lined up on this border. And at noon, on April 22nd, 1889, troops fired off cannons and guns and things, and everybody ran. Some people had racehorses, and some people had wagons, and some people were on foot. And they went into this huge territory. It was about half the size of Connecticut, and they were allowed to just stake claims. They found the land they wanted, and they put stakes down, and they kind of fought each other off, and so Oklahoma City was one of the most attractive spots in that territory, and it went from zero people to 10,000 people in a matter of hours.
You write about something strange that happened that very first night in Oklahoma City. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So one of the amazing things about Oklahoma City is because its origin was so late and so sudden, it was actually a media phenomenon in a way that the birth of a city tends not to be because they are kind of these ancient things that form slowly. Mm-hmm. But in the case of Oklahoma City, you actually had the first train car of the first train that went down to the city during the Land Run was full of media members. And you had places like Harper's that were out there writing about the birth of this new city. And so we know what happened. And we have historic accounts from people who were there. And on that first night, which would have been a very weird scene, if you can imagine, it's just kind of this empty prairie that is suddenly full of 10,000 people.
You've got this great sentence where you describe it as part Super Bowl tailgate party,
raid of Imperial Rome, and sleepover. And you just try to imagine that scene and being a part of this sudden community of strangers out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. They say caterpillars were swarming all over the place, and it was cold that night, and everyone's kind of looking around, wondering what's going on. And sometime around midnight, this call rang out in the air. Somebody shouted out of nowhere the sentence, "Oh, Joe, here's your mule." And nobody really knew what that meant. I mean, there were stories about who this guy Joe was, and he had left his lot for a while, and his mule wandered off, and somebody found it and called out to him, but nobody really knows. But anyway, somebody across town, because you could hear a voice, a human voice could cover the entire city at that point, somebody called back, "Oh, Joe, here's your mule." And it became this kind of little game in the middle of the night on the first night of Oklahoma City, where everyone was calling back and forth, "Oh, Joe, here's your mule," for a really long time, and just kind of fizzing into this new community, like forming this sudden identity by shouting this strange thing at each other.
"Oh, Joe, here's your mule. Joe, here's your mule.
And you have this great description of that. You say these words were a, quote, closed loop, an incantation through which Oklahoma City was going to chant itself into existence. Another fascinating event that happened in the history of Oklahoma City took place in 1964, the Sonic Boom Tests, known as Operation Bongo. Can you tell me about Operation Bongo?
I love Operation Bongo. This was probably my favorite, even on top of the Land Run, which blew my mind so many times. This was probably my favorite historical discovery. And it happened because I realized I did not know the origin of the name of the Seattle's old NBA team, the Supersonics, which is what eventually became the Oklahoma City Thunder. And I thought, well, I wonder why that team was called the Supersonics. It's kind of a strange name when you think about it. So I dove down that rabbit hole and came out with this amazing story of Operation Bongo, which is in the 1960s, the NBA was expanding toward the West Coast, and one of the cities that got a team was Seattle. And at that same moment, the United States was desperately trying to kind of catch up with competitors in the world in the arena of supersonic flight. The Russians were doing it, the French were doing it, and the USA wanted to do it as well. And they thought that supersonic flight was going to be the future of all aviation, and we'd all be riding around on supersonic jets from city to city every day. So they named the team as a kind of tribute to this project, which was based in Seattle, because Boeing was in Seattle. So they became the Seattle Supersonics. So you've got a team, and you've got this project of very fast flight. The big problem with supersonic flight, there are many, many little problems. One of the bigger problems was every time you take off, you create a sonic boom, which is a very loud, rumbling noise that kind of echoes everywhere underneath the jet.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, if we're doing this from every airport in the country every day, many times a day, are we going to drive Americans crazy who live under these flight paths? And they thought the only way to test this out was to actually try it on an American city and see how the citizens reacted. And I couldn't believe it, but the city that they chose from Seattle was Oklahoma City. And they ran this sonic boom test there for 6 months. They start launching these jets. They're going at obscene speeds. And out of nowhere, the people of Oklahoma City are hearing these cracking, thunderous blasts. And their houses are shaking. And there's these hilarious lists of all the damage being done in the city. People's dishes are falling out of cupboards and cracking. Somebody just told me that his father remembered as a kid a fishbowl exploding because of a particularly strong sonic boom.
Wow.
The citizens were kind of in an uproar immediately and started complaining, and the city council looked into it, and they told the Chamber of Commerce, you know, I think we might need to stop this whole crazy experiment. And the Chamber of Commerce said, no, you don't understand. Our whole future is at stake here. We have a chance to really make ourselves into a major player in this new era of flight. And so everybody backed off, and they let the experiment go on for 6 whole months.
So instead of driving Americans crazy, they basically drove the citizens of Oklahoma City crazy.
And they drove them so crazy that in the end, it killed the whole supersonic program. The report was just relentlessly negative about how people felt about these booms happening all day long. And the supersonic program never got off the ground in the United States.
Interesting. If there's an oddball cultural mascot for OKC, it's got to be Wayne Coyne, the frontman of the alternative psychedelic rock band, The Flaming Lips. And he still lives in OKC. And as you say, Wayne was famous enough in a slightly dangerous way. He was unpredictable to a degree that the conservative city didn't like. So what is the relationship like between Wayne Coyne and OKC?
I find it really funny. Wayne grew up in Oklahoma City. He never left Oklahoma City. He lives today in the same neighborhood that he grew up in, which is a kind of rundown area of the city, not particularly glamorous. It's become kind of cool because Wayne Coyne is there and you see him around doing his weird art projects and things. The nature of the Flaming Lips is just kind of endlessly experimental.
Yes.
And so you see Wayne all over town doing strange things. There was a period in the 90s where he was doing these parking garage experiments.
Yes, with all the playing the cassettes and queuing up and playing the same songs over and over and having them played on multiple vehicles, the same song, right?
He'd lure hundreds of people to this parking garage.
Well, and you spent a night participating in one of his secret midnight art projects, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
When you get into Wayne's orbit, you become part of Wayne's various projects, and you'll get texts from him at all hours of the night, and I thought of them as a sort of bat signal from Wayne that it was time to go do something.
You become part of Wayne's world.
You absolutely do. So one of the things I became part of was we were out one night, and he just kind of casually mentioned, hey, I was thinking about, you know how like streets are really boring and they're all the same color? Well, I was thinking that maybe we could paint like a giant rainbow all over the streets in Oklahoma City. Wouldn't that be cool? And I said, yeah, sure, Wayne, that would be cool. And it developed that actually he already had the paint. He had a plan in mind.
Of course.
So at some point I ended up at this house party with him and it was 4 a.m. And finally he said, all right, it's time. And he grabbed 6 of us. And we all went down to his house, which is this enormous place that everyone calls the compound, in the middle of Oklahoma City. We took these 6 cans of paint, the colors of the rainbow, and we lined up on the street and we poked holes in the bottom of them. And we just walked around his whole neighborhood dripping these lines for blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks that made this giant rainbow all over the streets of his neighborhood.
We can't talk about Oklahoma City without talking about the tragic bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building by Timothy McVeigh on April 19th, 1995. You say that you got to know people in Oklahoma City would tell you everything about their lives, every inch of the city, but they could not talk to you about anything they saw that day. And there must have been a few people, though, who talked to you about what they experienced that day. Weren't there?
Yeah, there were. I talked to people who were on the scene, and I talked to people who watched it on TV from blocks away and had this very surreal experience. Wayne Coyne himself was sleeping when the bomb went off, and his compound is not far from where the Murrah Building was, and it woke him up. He thought it was kind of just a neighborhood sound and fell back asleep and then realized later in the morning what had happened and actually rode his bike down there and just stood there looking at it for a while and rode back home. Yeah, I spoke to a guy who was the first journalist on the scene who kind of went right into the building and had to come running back out because there was another bomb threat. I mean, it was a citywide trauma that has lasted for generations now. And that, in fact, was something that people told me over and over again that was part of the Thunder's identity. People feel like the Thunder is this, I mean, it sounds trivial to say almost about a professional sports team, but people insisted it is this collective experience of joy, this identity that centers around achievement and happiness and fun that in some ways healed or helped to heal or canceled out a little bit some of the trauma and the tragic feelings that were really at the center of the place's collective identity since 1995.
And 23 years later, I would imagine there a lot of that trauma and the psychic damage still remains.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I felt myself drawn to the memorial at the site is really beautiful. And I think every day I've been in Oklahoma City, I've actually gone to the memorial. It's just kind of right in the center of everything. And it just sort of draws you through. It's free and open and you just kind of walk through and it's very quiet and peaceful. And Yeah, it's very much a part of everyone's lives there.
Final question, Sam. You live in New York City, but do you have enough of a love, and having spent 5 years writing this book, would you ever consider living in Oklahoma City?
People kept saying that to me in my time there. They're like, this is what happens. People come here and they're not expecting much, and they get swept away and they love it and they move here. I have to admit, I've had my eye on a couple of properties when I've passed through and seen places up. And I thought, that's a very nice house, a very charming area. I could do it. My family might not go with me, so that's probably a deal breaker.
Sam Anderson is the author of Boomtown. He's also a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. You can find out more about Sam at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Hear it again or catch up on past episodes by subscribing to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite artisanal small batch podcasts. And remember, you can get in touch with us anytime at beta@wpr.org or on Twitter @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our technical director and music director is Steve Gotcher.
The corn is as high as an elephant's eye.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Oklahoma, okay.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Don't laugh at my jokes.